with a different woman. She got a text message in the middle of the night at her bachelorette party from a woman who said, by the way, I wouldn't marry this guy if I were you because we've been seeing each other for the past little while, and even tonight, these are the text messages that he's been sending me. And they're explicit, so I'm not going to share them, obviously. But the basic idea was, he's cheating on her. So, what does she do? So she waits until the wedding itself. They've had the procession, she's wearing the beautiful white dress, and she gets to the part in the wedding where you exchange the vows, where you promise to, you know, love and protect and all the rest of it. And instead, she reads all the text messages. Right in front of everybody, in front of him and his parents and his family, and then she just says, see ya, I'm out of here. Now this is really cool because people saw this and they're like, right on, good for you. That's justice. What she did, kick him to the curb, embarrass him in public, he deserves it because that's a scummy thing to do, and he deserves every single thing that's coming his way. He doesn't deserve her. I definitely don't blame her for not marrying her, or marrying him. Amen?
Amen?
Amen. Okay, yeah. I'm glad everyone here is like, yeah, maybe don't marry the guy who's cheating on you the night before. Maybe. I would not want to be marrying somebody like that. If my friend came to me and said, I'm marrying somebody like that, I'd be like, get your head checked, because something here is wrong. And then we have Hosea, a prophet, really spiritual guy, like a pastor or, you know, an evangelist. And this guy marries a prostitute, an adulterous woman, because God tells him to do it. Hosea marries this woman named Gomer, knowing that she's unfaithful, knowing that she will be unfaithful to him. She is the adulterous woman after all. That's how she's described. Not the tall woman, or the short woman, or the fat woman, or the thin woman, or the woman with a good personality or a good heart. She's the adulterous one. And yet, Hosea chooses to marry her, and he chooses to love her. Now, this is a really weird marriage. Don't know if I'm going to be taking marriage advice from Hosea on this one. When I'm picking a wife, I don't know if I'm like, okay, how can I find somebody with the highest risk threshold for infidelity? But there's a lesson here. The lesson is that God does not abandon us in our sin. That God chooses to love us even though we do not deserve his love, and that he chases after us even when we are running away from him. Now, before we continue, we have to have a talk about a word that we don't use an awful lot. The word covenant. Is everybody here? Has everybody heard this word before? Just say, yeah. Okay, so most of the time we hear about this word at weddings because everyone's like, marriage covenant or the covenant of marriage. Basically, in our culture, that's it. Covenant means wedding, marriage, rings, all that. But in the Old Testament, a covenant was an agreement. It's a deal between two groups, and each side agrees to do something. So, just like in a marriage, you'll have the couple agreeing to love each other in sickness and health, rich or poor, whatever, until death do you part. I'm making it sound really boring and banal, but it's actually a very important thing that you're doing. So basically, in the ancient world, it'd be something that kings would do with their people. So, for example, a king would have a group of important lords. And he would basically say, okay, here's the deal. If you make a covenant with me, I will look out for you. I will protect you. If there are any big, strong enemies around, I got your back. And if there are any of the other lords who are fighting against you, I will come to your aid. In exchange, you have to do something for me. You have to pay me taxes. Chances are, if I'm going to go to war with somebody, you have to come when I call you. Basically, that's how the covenant worked. Now, this is the same thing that God had with his people, with Israel. So God actually makes several covenants with the people of Israel. He makes one with Abraham, the guy who's like, I'm going to sacrifice my son. And then the angel stops him, like, right at the nick of time. That guy. So God makes an agreement with him. He says, listen, Abraham, you worship me. You circumcise your sons, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. And then when there's Moses, after he takes the people of Israel out of Egypt, he says, basically the same thing, I will give you the land of Canaan, I will give you the land of milk and honey. If you have any enemies that are attacking you, don't worry, I will dust them for you. They're done. But in exchange, you have to do something for me. You have to worship only me. You have to obey my law. You have to obey my commandments. That's the deal. Just like a marriage, you have two parties, both agreeing to something, and then they have to do what they say. Now, here's my question. Does Israel do a good job at fulfilling their end of the bargain? Are they a faithful spouse to God? Let's put it this way. It takes Israel basically as long as it takes for Moses to come from the top of the mountain to the bottom with the Ten Commandments for them to start cheating on God. That's how long it takes. Basically, the honeymoon period was not even over before they were looking at me like, do I have any other options? Ooh, they look really good. That's how fast Israel takes to cheat. Now, Hosea is writing to these people, the people of Israel. And he's saying, listen, guys, we had a deal with God. The deal was, he gets our back, and we worship him. That's the deal. But now we're in trouble, because God, he is furious with us, because he caught us everywhere with different gods. What do we do now? The emphasis of Hosea is the first commandment, which, as kids, maybe you learned all the Ten Commandments, but the first one is the one that people of Israel can't stop breaking. It's kind of ironic when you think about it. The first one, they should remember it the most. Pretty simple. Worship one God. Not two, not three, not four, but one. Worship only the Lord your God. Don't worship any graven images. Just God. That's it. But here's the problem. In Hosea's world, nobody did that. You didn't worship just one God. You worshipped as many as you wanted. Two, three, four, one for every single day of the week. And every month if you wanted to. It was no big deal if you had many gods. Usually what you did was, you would worship as many of them as promised you, you know, favors or deals or whatever. It's kind of like you, how many of us only ever shop for clothes in one store? We are loyal to only one. No, chances are we're going to shop around. If somebody has a really good sale, or it's 50% off, or 70% off, or 80% off, maybe you go inside. How many of us are actually going to stay loyal to only one? So, the deal was, maybe you have a bad harvest, because everybody farmers back then. You have a sucky harvest. Nothing's growing. Well, your neighbor over there, he was praying to the god Baal, and he had a great harvest. He's like, dude, you should totally worship this God. And if you do, you're going to have a great harvest. And the guy's like, well, my harvest didn't turn out so great. Maybe I'll try that one. They figured that these gods didn't really care if you, you know, went after different gods. All they cared is, do you worship me some of the time? Do you give me offerings some of the time? They're really easy to please. All you have to do is send like a couple bucks their way, and they're like, okay, I will send you this blessing. They have open relationships with everybody. And then there's God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he is very strongly anti-open relationship. He is only interested in exclusive relationships. Now, a couple years ago, I was over at a buddy's house, and he was doing something, getting ready, and he had the TV on, and it was on TLC, which I don't usually watch for a lot of different reasons. But anyways, it was on Sister Wives. And I've only ever watched one episode in my life, and I watched it, and I'm like, so you're telling me that there's a guy who's married to four women at the same time, in the same house, with 18 kids. At the time, someone made a joke, they said, he wants to be married more than once? Four people? And I'm like, yeah, okay. And for me, that was so out there. I'm like, what are you doing? Four people at the same time? That cannot be a good idea. But in Hosea's time, everybody would do that with the gods. Just pick one. Pick two. And Israel gets tempted. Now Israel is surrounded by big, scary enemies. Egypt, no, because they escaped from there. Those people enslaved them. You got Assyria. The people who are so hungry for war, they just burn cities to the ground, they chop people's heads off, and make little pyramids out of them. You got the Babylonians, who never met a city they didn't like to take. You got the Persians, who are behind everybody to eventually become the biggest empire around. And then you got little tiny Israel. They're small. They're not that many people. It's actually very similar to Israel today. Israel is surrounded by different large countries. So they think to themselves, okay, maybe, here's an idea. If we have the same gods as the Babylonians, maybe they won't fight us. Because maybe they'll be like, well, we have the same gods, so we're cool, right? Maybe they think, okay, if we worship those gods promise us good harvests or a firstborn child or, you know, that they'll heal you from a disease, something like that. They gave you a promise. They said, yes, you worship, you've given sacrifice, no big deal. It becomes culturally acceptable in Israel to worship different gods other than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the best part is, Israel claims to be still faithful to God. They would describe themselves as faithful Jews, as people of the covenant. They would still be circumcising their children. Because they're saying, well, yeah, we're of Israel. At the same time as they are sleeping with different gods. And that is why God tells Hosea to go marry a prostitute. The unfaithful woman. Because it shows us what it must be like for God. So it's kind of strange for us because we don't usually spend a whole lot of time thinking about what God feels or likes. But imagine you're him for a second. He had a deal with them, and they broke it. He was faithful to them, and they started seeing different gods. But it's more than that. It's not just that commandment to be exclusive. Because, I mean, that's very important in a relationship, but there are other things too. It's not just that Israel worships other gods, but it's also that they break God's law. They don't treat people properly. The poor, the widows, the refugees, the aliens. God has very specific instructions about what to do. And they're like, eh, who cares? Their kings lie, cheat, murder, steal. They take things that don't belong to them. They fight wars against their own people, against other people. You know what they do? They behave just like everybody else. They do the same things as every other country around them. They ally themselves with these countries to protect them. And all they needed was God in the first place. So, how would you respond if you're in a relationship like that? Would you stay faithful to a cheating spouse? I mean, they've already split in the relationship. They can't really get offended if you start seeing other people. It's like, well, you did it first. So why can't I? Why does God just not choose to pick a different people? Maybe the Israelites didn't work out so well. I mean, they weren't even faithful on the honeymoon, so maybe he'll have a better chance at a second marriage. Maybe he should pick the Assyrians, because they're the most warlike, so maybe he'll have more success with those people. Maybe he should choose the Ethiopians, because they're far enough away from Israel that clearly they're not tainted by whatever cultural practices they have. I was reading an article the other day where the National Post argued that we should get more comfortable with the idea of non-exclusive relationships. The idea that we should be faithful to one spouse for our entire life is just not reasonable. That there are just too many different ways that men or women, we'd be tempted to sleep with different people. We have dating apps. We have the internet. Oh gosh, we have the internet. And really, it's too much to ask for us to stay faithful for our entire lives. I'm 27 now, dating myself, I know. 27 now. How many years am I expecting to live? Maybe another 50? Maybe. If I keep myself in good shape, maybe longer. Laughing, because maybe not even that much. Am I really expecting to be faithful to my spouse for all that time? They argue that, you know, really cheating is the new normal for us. That we should get comfortable with the idea that really it isn't a deal breaker in relationships to cheat. That actually it can be helpful and healthy for a relationship, because then you have a time where you can get rid of all those bad habits that built up. Because, you know, you get comfortable if you're married and you're like, well, they're not going to leave me, are they? So, I mean, you know, I can stop trying. And I was offended. This legitimizes people sleeping around. It gives them an excuse where they're like, honestly, man, I was designed this way to just say left or right. I mean, she's hot, and my wife, I love her, but is not. It makes it seem normal for people to get hurt this way. It takes away from the idea that it is very wrong and hurtful for people to cheat in relationships. And I get angry at the idea of people reading this, finding out that their spouse is cheating on them, and then thinking that it's all their fault. Or that it's somehow for the best, that it makes them a better, stronger person. But then I encounter this dilemma. What does God do with people in a relationship just like that? People who are unfaithful. Consistently unfaithful. It's not like it was just a one-time thing. It's like every different day it's something. What should God do with a people that cheat on him? What would you do to a person who constantly cheats on you? Well, this is what God is at first. He gets pissed. He is furious. He is angry. Did you see the names that he told Hosea to give his kids? Oof. Oh, man. Like, I look at my name and I'm like, thank you, Mom and Dad, for giving me a name that doesn't mean God has abandoned us or you are not loved or all these crazy things. Hosea's kids must be like, why can't I have a normal dad? But no, God is furious. He is angry. His people promised him that they would be loyal to him. And then they broke that promise. After everything God had done for Israel. Remember, none of those pagan gods did anything for Israel when they were stuck in Egypt. Who saved them? God. When they were wandering the desert because they couldn't read a map for 40 years, who gave them food and gave them water? God did. When they came to the land of Israel, and they're surrounded by enemies that are 6 feet tall and, you know, got spears the size of, you know, me. Who went to bat for them? God did. Do you remember the battle where Moses has to keep his hands up? As long as he keeps his hands up, the Israelites are winning. The moment his hands go down, they start losing. That has nothing to do with Moses and his armpits or smell or anything like that. It has everything to do with God coming through for his people. And they look at that and say, but that God over there, maybe he does this for me. And God's like, no, what are you doing? Everything he did for them, and they still choose to be unfaithful. And God is furious, and he is right to be angry. So, God gives Israel exactly what they want. Now, this is all in Hosea chapter 2, which we didn't read aloud. But basically, the premise is, listen, you wanted to have all these other gods because they give you all these different things. You wanted to be out of this exclusive relationship with me. You want to have an open relationship. Okay, then you can take your stuff. Skedaddle, get out of here. Oh, sorry, you thought that you could just keep all the gifts that I gave you? How about no? All the blessings of the land he gives to other countries. It reads like this. She, meaning Israel, will chase after her lovers but not catch them. She will look for them but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal. God is going to use Israel's sin to teach them a lesson. He's saying, you thought you were in all these things because you were stronger or smarter or better at business than everybody else. Guess what? It was all me. It always was. There is nothing special about Israel other than the fact that they have God on their side. And they have to learn that the hard way. Because as I said earlier, Israel, very small. Other countries around them, really big. They don't have a chance by themselves. So he takes back all of his protection. Every blessing that he gives them, he says, I'm going to pull it back. He leaves Israel to their kings. The kings, by the way, they asked for because all the other nations have kings. Remember, Israel started with God, his people, and the judges, the people who were appointed by God to rule over them. He gives them the chance to pray to these pagan foreign gods and say, listen, you think that they do a better job of protecting you than me? Have at it, Hoss. Worship them. See where that gets you. Because the people of Israel need to learn that by themselves they are finished. That the real reason Israel made a covenant with God was because they needed him, not the other way around. But here's the thing. God's forgiveness, it trumps his anger at our sin. Because even though, yeah, he's pissed, he's furious, as we would be, his desire to judge them is still there, but it cools down a little bit. And that's why you see, even in the first chapter, you see this balance where God's like, I'm going to leave them forever and they will never be my people. And then he goes, but then I will make them my people again. God still loves his people. His impulse to judge gives way to his desire to forgive. His fierce anger is overcome by his compassion. And he chooses to forgive. Later in Hosea chapter 11, he writes, I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim, meaning Israel, again. For I am God and not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. There is nothing we can do that can separate us from God's love. In compassion, God promises to restore Israel, even though they are cheating on him still. And not because of anything they have done. At this point, Israel has made no move to be like, oh, I'm very sorry, God, for what I've done. I will never do it again. They've done nothing. And God's like, but I will forgive, and I will build you up again. At the end of Hosea chapter 2, even though God has already shown that Israel deserves judgment, he says, I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called, not my loved one. I will say to those called, not my people, you are my people. And you will say, you are my God. Even Israel's sin, even Israel's unfaithfulness could not separate them from God's love. So what? I'm not born in Israel. I'm not an Israeli. I'm not an Israelite. What does it matter to me if God chooses to restore Israel? What does it matter to you? Unless, of course, you're from Israel. At which point, you know, ignore that part. We live in Canada. Canada's not mentioned in Hosea. Not once. In the whole Bible, never once mentions Canada. Mainly because Canada is relatively new and the Bible is extremely old. But not the point. Hosea's message was originally intended for Israel. But it also has implications for us too. Are we really any better than Israel? Are we? Are we more faithful than the Jews at the time of Hosea? Okay, I'll give you this concession. Maybe we don't go to foreign temples to make sacrifices and offerings. Maybe you do. But most of us in Canada don't tend to do that. If we go to a church, usually we stay in our churches. If we go to temples, we stay in our temples, basically. It's not common for Christian people to go to different worship services in different faiths and to make offerings. Maybe you honor the first commandment. Yay. You're already doing a little bit better. The problem is that that's not the only commandment. God has plenty of other things that he wants us to do. It's not just only worship me. The problem is that we break other commandments. Sacrificing on the altars of foreign gods is only one of them. How many of us worship other things? Success. Personal success. Worship physical stuff. I knew a woman that I went to school with. The entire point of her life, she said to me, this is a Christian lady, she said to me, the whole point of her life was the American dream. All she wanted was a big house, a white picket fence, with a dog, and a Chevy. That's it. That was her dream. If anything else interfered with that, she's like, nope, don't want it. That's all I want. Do we worship ourselves? Do we think that we are the center of the universe? Everything depends on how it affects me. Does it inconvenience me? Am I the center of my universe? You see, this is the problem. If you don't make the agreement with God, you don't have to follow the conditions. But when we choose to follow Jesus, when we choose to say, yes, I make him Lord, not friend, not companion, by the way, but Lord, that means something. It means he becomes the highest authority. It means what he says matters. That means our lives follow his as an example. Jesus says in John chapter 14, if you love me, then that's good enough. You don't have to do anything else. No, he doesn't say that. He says, if you love me, then obey my commandments. The marker of a Christian is not just what you believe, but what you do. Faith and good works together. A good tree bears good fruit. So if you believe, then what? Do we love Jesus and obey his commandments? Because if not, then we are just as guilty as Gomer, and we are just as unfaithful. Because, yeah, you can get baptized. And please, if you are not baptized, get baptized. We can confess our sins. We can go to church. We can read our Bibles. We can even pay attention when the pastor is preaching for 5 to 10 minutes. But our hearts don't change. What we do doesn't change. We do the same stupid stuff that we've always done. We don't love people. And I'm not talking about like, I'm talking about love. Because we can love people we don't actually like. Because there are plenty of people that are just unlikable. But we can still love them. We can still care for them. Do we serve other people, looking out for them? Or do we only care about ourselves? Are we honest? Do we speak the truth? Are we dependable? Is our word our bond? Do we care for the poor, the needy, the people that nobody else cares about? Are we greedy, jealous of what other people have, envious of their success? Are we too afraid to tell people what we believe in our hearts to be true, that we do need Jesus in our life? Basically, let's sum it up this way. If somebody looked at your life, could they tell that you're a Christian person? Or would they think, do you just show up? Because you have to. Hosea's relationship with Gomer is also an illustration of Jesus' relationship with us. Jesus died on a cross so we might live. To serve and honor God with our lives. Are we honoring that? Are we faithful to that call? Listen what happens next. In Hosea chapter 3, it reads, the Lord said to me, Hosea, go, show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethic of barley. Then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way towards you. Break that down. Hosea has to go ransom his wife from her pimp. Yikes. That's some drama that I was not prepared for in the Bible. Yes, there are pimps in the Bible. Now you know. So not only does God make Hosea marry this prostitute, he makes three kids with her. He gives them terrible names. And then she jumps ship and goes to be with another guy. So Hosea is a single parent with three kids. And then, to make it even worse, God says, okay, Hosea, if I haven't embarrassed you enough, I need you to go find your wife who is unfaithful to you, because she's a prostitute, in case you didn't know. And I need you to go pay the guy who's pimping her out. The fact that Hosea didn't punch him in the face or knock him out or something like that is a miracle. The reason why is because this guy owned her. And Hosea does it. How messed up is that? Hosea does it because he loves her. Not because he particularly likes her at the minute, that minute. I don't know if I'd be liking anybody at that minute. I have to go pay off a pimp to save them because they got themselves in the situation. But in the same way, Jesus does the exact same thing for me. The big lie of our generation is that Jesus died for me because I'm a good person, which is just a flat-out not true statement. That somehow I deserve Jesus going on the cross? The truth is that we are not good people worth dying for. We're not. We're not. Jesus died for us even though we were his enemy, even though we were unfaithful to him, even though we were, just like Gomer, pimping ourselves out to a different god, or a different idol, or to a different lifestyle. And even though we were unfaithful to God, breaking his law, sinning, thinking or doing evil things, God does not abandon us. He doesn't abandon us. Instead, he offers to save us. Even when we are unfaithful, God is faithful to us. That's why I follow Jesus. I follow him because he chose to love me when I was not worthy of being loved. He forgave me when he should have and could have easily judged me for what I have done in my life. Because he takes away any guilt or shame that I have, he takes away that sin, and he says, I will give you life. Think about Hosea and Gomer for a second. Do you think Hosea would have just brought that up to Gomer anytime they were having a fight? Well, you know, yeah, I know. Yeah, maybe I snore a lot, but you know what I don't do? I don't cheat on you and then have to go pay your pimp to get you back. Do you really think that's how Hosea was to his wife? A man who does something like that never brings it up, ever again. Because he loves her. Our sin is great enough to mean being separated from God forever. But is not enough to stop him from chasing after you and me. Hosea marries Gomer knowing that she will be unfaithful. She's got the track record. Prove it. He has sex with her, knowing that she will not keep that sacred between him and her, knowing that she will do that with other people that he doesn't even know. That intimacy is gone. There's no chance of that anymore. Because there's nothing special between what Hosea and Gomer have, because she does it for money, with anybody who wants it. And yet he still loves her. And when God says, go save her, he says, Yes, Lord. Our salvation is not dependent on who we are or what we do. It's not. It is totally and 100% dependent on God and who He is and what He wants most, which is to see people whose hearts are away from Him come back to Him. Not because He's like, you know what, everybody, you should be worshiping me because I'm great, you know? But because He knows that without Him, we are lost. Now, there is something that we do actually have to do. We have to accept it. We have to be willing to ask God for forgiveness for our sin. We can't just say, the blood of Jesus covers everything, but my sin I don't say anything about. I don't confess it. I ignore it. I'm like, well, at least I'm not an axe murderer. Good for you. What about the fact that you beat your kids? That you abuse them physically? Or that you're emotionally abusive to your elderly parents? Whatever it is. We're not necessarily angels. God does not abandon us to our sin. He rushes towards us because of our sin. He sees us as we are. This is God. It's not like He doesn't know that we have sinned before. He knows it. He's seen it. Before He went to the cross, He saw everything that would happen and still chose to save us. He still chose to save you. So no matter what you do, God knew about it ahead of time and still decided to die for you. So then live like it. Live boldly and confidently. If God is willing to love you when you're His enemy, and now you're on His side, what is He going to do with you now? The story of Gomer reminds us that God is still in control and that there is nowhere we can go where He cannot follow. And that He's actively working for our good and the good of the people we love and care about. And we don't need to look anywhere other than the cross.